So, Crimea, is it Ukrainian or Russian? Today, Thursday, March 6th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Crimea's parliament plans a referendum to decide if the region stays in Ukraine or joins Russia. Our correspondent in Crimea says the vote feels like an afterthought.
Russians are already in control of the peninsula. Their troops are everywhere. They have the pro-Moscow government that fully supports them. And a great number of people here actually welcome this.
And later, a pastor from Syria describes the plight of Christians in his homeland.
The minorities are asked either to pay a tax, Islamic tax, for their protection, or become Muslims, or get killed.
And we find out why Syria's ambassador to the UN can't travel as freely anymore.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you're confused about who's in charge of Crimea, don't worry, you're not alone. Even our correspondent there, the BBC's Natalia Antalava, had to correct me when we called her earlier today.
You realize I'm in Russia, right?
Technically, where are you?
I'm in Simferopol, but technically, I'm now in Russia because It has just been declared to be Russia.
As Natalia was hinting at there, the regional government in Crimea, which leans to Moscow, has now declared the region to be part of Russia. It also announced that the Crimean people will vote on the matter in a referendum in 10 days. President Obama reacted by saying the vote itself would be a violation of international law. In the Crimean capital of Simferopol, Natalia says the reaction was mixed, but leaning toward positive.
Depending on whom you ask, there are plenty of people here who will be very pleased. 60% of the population in Crimea is Russian, although that doesn't mean that all of them support joining the Russian Federation. But most Russians I've been talking to have been saying that they want to see a greater autonomy and closer relationship with Russia. And some have been saying that they see their future as part of the Russian Federation. So there will be a lot of people here who will be happy to hear the news. But there are also lots of people who are deeply unhappy and very, very worried about what that means to them.
Is there anything, Natalia, there in Simferopol resembling a Ukrainian local government that's taking orders from Kiev right now?
No, there isn't. Kiev doesn't really have much of a foothold here, really. And a difficult situation will be with the military bases, because there are many military bases around the peninsula. And the strategic ones for days and days now have been blocked by Russian soldiers. They're still in their unmarked uniforms in balaclavas. And President Putin says that they're not Russian soldiers. But the local Crimean government that passed this resolution to join the Russian Federation admitted that there are Russian soldiers in Crimea. And according to them, it's the Ukrainian soldiers that are now the occupying force, because the parliament passed this resolution that Crimea is now part of Russia.
What is this resolution really worth on paper if Kiev doesn't recognize it?
Well, nothing, according to Kiev. But the real question here is, what is Kiev's non-recognition of this resolution worth if they can't really do anything about it? Russians are already in control of the peninsula. Their troops are everywhere. They have the pro-Moscow government that fully supports them. So the question for Kiev is, what will the international community and what will Kiev be able to do to somehow resolve this?
So from your vantage point, Natalia, today, Thursday, March 6th, will Ukraine fight for Crimea?
That's a million-dollar question. And the answer is, I don't know. But can Ukraine afford to give up Crimea? I was talking to a EU ambassador today who was talking about the dangers of allowing President Putin to take over the Crimea. If this happens here, which has already happened in Georgia, in Abkhazia, in South Ossetia, in Moldova, now here, what's next? How far will President Putin go? Will the international community allow it? I mean, Russia doesn't seem to show many signs of wanting to engage with the government in Kiev. Today, during the talks between John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in Paris, someone asked Lavrov whether he was willing to meet his Ukrainian counterpart. His answer was, "Who's that?" This is a real deadlock. And on the line here is obviously the future of the entire peninsula and of many, many people who are very unhappy with this decision.
The BBC's Natalia Antalava speaking with us from Simferopol, the capital of Crimea. Thank you, Natalia.
Thank you.
Ukraine's ability to weather this crisis will depend a lot on its economy. There is crucial natural gas that fuels its economy, and it comes from Russia. So what will happen if the Kremlin turns off the tap or jacks up fuel prices? That weighs heavily as well on mines in Washington. Today, U.S. officials said they're considering using American natural gas resources to ease the crisis in Ukraine. The supply of natural gas is not only critical to Ukraine's future, but also Europe's. That's according to Jeffrey Mankoff at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Most of the pipelines that bring oil and particularly gas from Russia to Europe pass through Ukraine. And right now, about a quarter of Europe's gas consumption comes from Russia. So what that means is that any kind of political instability in Ukraine potentially threatens supplies of Russian gas to European consumers. And that's one reason that the EU has been waiting very carefully in the Ukrainian waters since this crisis has broken out.
What exactly has the Kremlin done so far to kind of close the tap?
Well, so far, they've announced that a discount on price for gas that was negotiated before the Yanukovych government fell is no longer going to be honored, so that gas prices are going to be raised again. And that, of course, is one of the reasons that Ukraine has been in such a vulnerable position all these years, is because they've accumulated huge debts to Gazprom, the Russian state energy company, in part because they've been unwilling to charge market rates for domestic consumers to be able to recoup their costs. And since they have this huge amount of debt, Gazprom has given the Kremlin an excuse, if necessary, to turn off the taps simply because the Ukrainians haven't paid for the deliveries that they've received.
Now, this is not news, I gather, for Russia. It's got a history of tightening natural gas supplies when conflicts erupt, right?
Yeah, this has been an issue in relations between Russia and Ukraine for quite some time now. There were major gas crises in both 2006 and 2009. And in 2006, this was shortly after the so-called Orange Revolution, which brought a very pro-Western government to power in Kiev. And it was perceived at the time as being, in part, Russian retaliation for the Ukrainian government's efforts to move away from Russia and to move closer to Europe, including potentially to NATO, which was then being discussed.
How nervous is Europe with all of this, especially with kind of Ukraine being ahead of them on the natural gas stream?
Compared to where Europe was in 2006 or 2009 when these other crises broke out, today the Europeans are in a better position, in part because they've instituted liberalization reforms within the EU itself to make the gas market there more liquid. Also because of just changes in the global natural gas market, largely as a result of the shale boom in the United States, which just means that there is more gas available from a wider variety of sources. And so there's a greater degree of flexibility that the EU has right now. That said, obviously, there are transition costs and there's a time lag between when any sort of contingency plan can be put into place. So the EU is still going to be concerned.
Right. We've also heard that this has been a particularly mild winter. So it doesn't look or sound like Ukrainians, even if gas, I don't know, doubles in price, that they would freeze this year.
Right. And there's also more gas in storage this time around, partially because there's warmer weather. So at least in Europe, the number I've heard is up to about 3 months of gas storage.
So we've got the advent of fracking as well. A lot of controversy over that here and in Europe, but it's already producing a bonanza for natural gas in some places. Could fracking change the equation in terms of Russia's leverage over Ukraine and the rest of Europe?
It's definitely having an effect. And I would say the shale gas revolution in the United States means that there's now a lot more gas on the market globally. So a couple of years ago, when it looked like the United States was going to be a major importer of gas, all of this liquefied natural gas that was being produced in places like Qatar was supposed to come to the United States. But what's happened is that over the last couple of years, as the United States has basically become self-sufficient in gas, those LNG cargoes from Qatar, Algeria, and other places have been freed up to go on international markets. And so that provides additional sources to Europe.
Sounds like you're seeing the U.S. role in Ukraine right now as being both diplomatic but also playing the energy natural gas angle.
Yeah, and that's something that the administration has emphasized, and it's something that it's prioritized. There is some resistance to this in Congress, obviously. And even if the politics could be solved, simply the fact of the matter is there's a transition period. You know, there aren't these LNG export terminals operating in the United States right now that would allow for these deliveries to make their way to Europe. That's something that is being looked at, and I think over the next couple of years you're going to see more of these come online. But they have to be built, they have to be approved, they have to be tested and put into operation, and that's going to take some time.
Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
With so much at stake, governments around the globe are watching Ukraine closely, especially China. It's in a somewhat awkward position. Beijing has built up close cooperation with Kiev over the years, but it doesn't want to offend the much larger power in the showdown, Russia. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
Ukraine has become an important partner for China. Beijing is a major grain importer, and despite all its economic troubles, Ukraine has an advanced agricultural system. The two countries also cooperate on military matters. They're developing weapons systems together. Last December, as protests raged in Kiev, then-President Viktor Yanukovych made an official visit to the People's Republic of China, and he reportedly secured $8 billion in Chinese investments.
So in that sense, it just showed that the Chinese government was not anticipating that Yanukovych would be gone so soon.
Dali Yang is a political scientist at the University of Chicago.
Of course, the developments certainly represent a setback for the relations between China and the Ukraine.
It's safe to say that Beijing was not very happy about the mass demonstrations in Ukraine. Dali Yang says the Chinese leadership felt the same about Ukraine's Orange Revolution a decade ago and all the other color revolutions, as well as the more recent Arab uprisings.
Every time something like that happens, it just makes the Chinese much more alert to the potential for instability within China.
Events in Ukraine also touch a nerve for Chinese nationalists. Take a recent editorial in China's Global Times newspaper this week. It blamed Western interference for creating the crisis in Ukraine, and it said Moscow deserves Beijing's support for standing up to Western pressure. Chinese leaders might agree with that assessment, but they're more careful in their public statements, says Bruce Gilley, because the truth is Russia's intervention in Crimea puts them in a real bind.
This is probably the biggest dilemma in Chinese foreign policy since the end of the Cold War.
Gilley is an expert on Chinese politics at Portland State University. He says President Xi Jinping and his advisors are juggling conflicting interests.
Their natural reaction is to side with Russia in this crisis. This is consistent with their grand strategy to weaken U.S. and Western global leadership. On the other hand, they have national interests at stake here, which involve their relationship with the Ukraine and wanting to not support any violation of any country's territorial boundaries.
For China, the principle of non-interference is sacrosanct. Think Tibet, Xinjiang, and Taiwan. If any of these potential trouble spots erupted, Beijing would not welcome outside meddling. That's why Russia's forceful intervention in Ukraine presents problems for the Chinese leadership. Again, Bruce Gilley.
First of all, China doesn't want to tie itself to a global troublemaker.
That would undermine the reputation Beijing is trying to build for itself as a force for global peace and stability. And secondly, Gilley says,
you know, this crisis has the potential to create a slowdown in the global economic recovery. Just at the time when Chinese growth is slowing and the Chinese currency actually has been taking a hit on currency markets.
China must be worried that the crisis in Ukraine could end up becoming a drag on its own economy. And that's something President Xi might have brought up when he spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. In a statement today from China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a top official stressed that the rights of all ethnic groups in Ukraine should be accommodated. And he called for all parties to exercise restraint. It was a carefully worded message, and it probably fell short of the kind of endorsement that Moscow was hoping to hear from its friends in Beijing. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Later on The World, a TV anchor with Russia State TV quits on air over the Ukraine crisis. We've got the backstory coming up on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Arab Spring, it was good for some countries where citizens rose up. Tunisia came through the protest better off. Libya cast off a dictator. But Syria's version of the Arab Spring, clearly a disaster. So it's notable when you see fighters from Libya going to Syria. Now, there have been lots of foreign fighters in the war in Syria on both sides for some time, but the story we're going to tell you now is about one young fighter from Libya who went to Syria and his older brother, Mohammed, who desperately wants him back home. Our reporter Marine Olivezi starts her story on a stretch of coast in Libya.
This is a spot dear to Mohammed's heart, a Roman amphitheater with the Mediterranean sparkling behind it. It's been his hideout during good times and bad.
It's a beautiful place, huh?
When I was a kid, my father was bringing us here. I found myself have problems or something. I came here just to relax, look at the sea and thinking.
Mohammed spent hours here at the end of the Libyan revolution, thinking about the exhilaration and death that defined the 9 months of the uprising. But these days, it's not the ghost of the Libyan war that haunt him. I first met Mohammed in January, in a much less grandiose sight. It was his fourth week in the dusty town of Kilis, at the Turkish-Syrian border. He was on a mission to find his 15-year-old brother, Ayub, who had slipped out of Libya and gone to fight in Syria, and to bring him home.
Every night I didn't sleep, I just trying to call, but no answer. Like this, that means it's out of course.
During the day, Mohammed would approach people who would cross the border, asking for tips on where his brother might be. At night, he would tirelessly dial the same three phone numbers he had for his brother and other contacts. Nothing worked, but Mohammed refused to lose hope.
I promised myself that I want to go back with him. I don't want to go back alone. Even if you take here, I will take here.
Mohammed says he feels guilty. During the Libyan uprising, he was a celebrated fighter. In Sirte, he was part of the small group of rebels who caught and killed Gaddafi's son, Mutasim. He's proud of that, but also believes that his brother, who was an impressionable 12-year-old at the time, went to Syria to be a hero like him.
He said to me after our revolution, all the time, he said to me, I want to be like you. I want to do the same way that you done. And I asked him, it will never can be because there is no revolution for you. You have to live now. I do that for you too. You have to live. You have to look for your future.
Ayub's future looked good. His mother says the teenager was well at school, respected his elders, and lived a comfortable life. She began to get worried when Ayub started bringing up Syria time and again.
It all started because of the media. He was watching the satellite channels, and they would bring up all these bad pictures. He would ask me about it and mention the names of cities in Syria. He also started chatting on the internet with people his age in Syria, and I think they planted the idea in his head to go there.
On December 25th, Ayub was supposed to be at school, but instead he headed off to Istanbul with a school friend. Mohammed followed him to Turkey the next day, but it was too late. At the border, he met a smuggler who confirmed his worst fear. Ayub was already inside Syria. And he wasn't just with any rebel group, but with the most radical bunch, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. It's a brigade made up mostly of foreign jihadists and affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Mohammed says he would have been suicidal to chase his brother into Syria. So he used middlemen, Syrians with connections who might help. Days and weeks passed, and things got grimmer. One day, Ayub posted on Facebook two pictures of himself in Aleppo. He's carrying a Kalashnikov and dressed in a traditional Arabic outfit instead of his usual jeans and t-shirt. But for Mohammed, the most disturbing part of it is Ayub's hand sign.
Look at.
During the revolution, Libyan fighters always raised two fingers, a V for victory. On this picture, though, Ayub points his forefinger up to the sky.
Because we do that. Two fingers win, and one finger dying. And one finger just one God and dying for the God.
When Ayub finally called his mother, she asked him to come back. He said he wouldn't. It's better for me to be in Syria, he told her. I won't go to heaven if I spend time with you, but if I stay in Syria, I will. The last straw came after about a month in Turkey, when Ayub posted an angry Facebook message calling Mohammed a kafir, or infidel. Mohammed says he was ready to fight for his brother, but not to fight against him. So he decided to leave Turkey. I failed, he told me then. We lost him. Mohammed says the jihadist group in Syria brainwashed his brother, but he says Libya has failed young people like Ayub as well.
We started a revolution and we didn't finish it. Families now, they are screaming about the revolution. It's our mistake, unfortunately.
Libyan teenagers now look at all the armed militias around and think guns and fighting are the answer. Now back in Libya, Mohammed wants to make sure his youngest brother, Abdelhamid, who's 9, doesn't fall into the same trap. Mohammed spends more time at home these days and ponders whether to move the family out of Libya. As for Ayub, Mohammed thinks getting him back alive from Syria would be nothing short of a miracle. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi, Homs, Libya.
As you heard in Marine's story, the attraction of fighting holy war in a foreign country can be irresistible for some people. There's danger and adventure mixed with a sense of religious duty. Here's another example of someone whose story starts a few years ago. This man, who spoke anonymously with the BBC, is a Muslim who lived a fairly comfortable life in Saudi Arabia until the Balkan Wars in Europe compelled him to act.
At that time, it was the Bosnian conflict raging, and I felt it was a responsibility on anyone with a conscience, basically, to do something. But the international community at that time did not do enough, and so it was one of those crazy moments in one's life where you take a decision and then you act upon it. And so I went to join the jihad there. At later time, when I went to Afghanistan and joined the training camps there, it was then that I was more or less attracted to the ideology of Al-Qaeda, and then I joined them.
The man says at one point, motivated by thoughts of martyrdom and anger toward the West, he became a preacher and a recruiter for radical Islam, first in places where Muslims gathered and later online. He says his was a culture of death.
You know, one of the ironies is that we never feared death, but we feared imprisonment because, you know, imprisonment is something that confines you physically and spiritually in a place, while martyrdom is regarded as something that will free your spirit.
He says he worked alongside Osama bin Laden, whom he admired at the time. But after 12 years in 4 different war zones, he admits he feels partially responsible for the deaths he and others he recruited caused. But he's now living in the UK and offering his advice to the British government on how to dissuade more British Muslims from joining the jihadist movement in places like Syria. He says officials need to be more proactive.
They must spell out clearly that while they respect and admire the motives of those who want to go there because they want to help others, they do not trust the motives of those who will host them there. This journey could begin with a noble motive and ends with a tragedy. They might come back changed people and also with sinister motives.
The man who did not want to be named is a former member of Al-Qaeda. He spoke recently to the BBC. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, being gay in Cameroon.
There you have to hide who you are. The police will come and arrest you.
Now this woman and her partner are refugees in America.
We kiss in public. I take her hand. We walk together. That was impossible in Cameroon.
But it's still far from easy. Their story just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. There's house arrest, and then there's what I'll call city arrest. That's what the U.S. has effectively done to Bashar Jafari. He's Syria's current ambassador to the United Nations, and right now he's confined to within a 25-mile radius of the U.N. building in New York City. Syrian-American groups opposed to President Bashar al-Assad had long been asking for that, accusing the diplomat of using his travels to spread misinformation. Colm Lynch covers the UN for Foreign Policy magazine. He says it's not an unprecedented move.
This is a sort of procedure that, you know, the U.S. has used for, you know, decades, you know, going back to the Cold War, where they have placed these restrictions on, initially on the Soviet Union, they do it on the Iranians, they've done it on the North Koreans' governments that we have sort of difficulties with. You know, I'm sure during some periods they probably had FBI people, particularly following the Soviets around to see if they were, you know, kind of getting into trouble or going beyond where they were supposed to go. But I think it's a question that if you go outside the 25 and you get caught, then you're in trouble. If you're a low-level diplomat, then maybe, you know, you get shipped out of the country. They might make exceptions, you know, if they're trying to sort of improve relations with a country. I mean, they let the North Koreans, for instance, take a bus trip to Atlanta, Georgia during the Olympics so they could see North Korean athletes. There's usually some flexibility built into it, but, you know, the notion is that, you know, you can't go out to the Hamptons.
With Ambassador Jaffari, I gather it's not just him, but the whole Syrian delegation. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's a pretty small delegation. I mean, I only know a couple. I only see a few of them, like three of them occasionally. I mean, I know, you know, one of his diplomatic aides, but I don't think it's a very, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's not very big.
So how will they keep track of him? Just U.S. Marshals outside his home?
No, they won't do that. I mean, essentially, you know, if he gets on a plane, you know, I suspect he's on a list and they'll say, you know, excuse me, thank you very much, but you're not going to Washington today or wherever else you want to go. You know, you're on the list and they're basically saying, you know, you got to follow these rules. And if you break the rules and they find out, then you get in trouble. I don't know what they would do to the Syrian ambassador. You know, would they throw him out of the country? I kind of doubt it. But, you know, they might do that with some of the kind of more junior diplomats.
There are worse cities than New York to be stuck in.
Yes, this is true.
Basically, though, Colm, the State Department siding with this coalition of Syrian Americans, effectively censoring Mr. Jaffari. Is there a freedom of expression issue here?
You know, in terms of your relationship with foreign governments, they're, you know, they can't go to an American court and sort of, you know, try and exercise First Amendment rights. Mm. So I think that there are a lot of things that they could do or that which are not consistent with open and free debate. One of the things I'm curious about is sort of why are they doing it right now? And, you know, UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi had kind of blamed Jaffari for, you know, scuttling the talks with the opposition. So, you know, is it retaliation for that? Is it build up over this, you know, kind of long, difficult period that they've had in relations with the Syrians? Is it a kind of shot across the, you know, the bow at the Russians? Is it related to Ukraine? I mean, are they sending a message that life is going to be more difficult for you and your allies now that you're doing this in Ukraine? So
you think it could be any of those?
I think it could be a combination of any of them. I mean, it may have been something they were planning for some time, but it's, you know, you always like wonder like about the timing for these sorts of things.
It all makes me wonder, though, where this move leaves dialogue between the U.S. and Syria. Does it kind of suffocate the channels of communication?
Not really. I mean, Jaffari is in New York at the UN doing what he has been doing. I mean, relations have not been good, but the Syrians, they have a representative here who can talk to the Americans, who can talk to the Europeans, the Arabs, to anybody else. So they won't lose that presence.
Our friend Colm Lynch, the correspondent at the UN for Foreign Policy magazine. Always great to speak with you, Colm. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for having me, Marco. Take care.
In Syria itself, the conflict grinds on. Rebel groups are still fighting the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. They also keep fighting among themselves, as the more moderate opposition groups do battle against extremist Islamist rebels. For Christians living in areas controlled by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, also known as the ISIS, life is becoming increasingly hard. In the northern city of Raqqa, Christians have been told they must pay a yearly tax to the extremist group for their own safety. Nadim Nasser is a Syrian Christian pastor who now lives in London, but he's closely following the plight of Christians in Syria.
In the West, not many people know that Syria is the birthplace of Christianity, where Jesus Christ was born and grew up. Even in the present time, they tell me or they ask me, Father, when did you become Christian? As if I was Muslim and became Christian. My family goes back to St. Paul. On the road to Damascus, St. Paul became a Christian, and that Damascus is the same Damascus that is the capital of Syria today, where the Christians are persecuted. we lived with Muslims and other minorities in Syria for centuries. And the secret is coexistence. And now we are being persecuted only for being Christians. The situation in Raqqa is awful.
So what the Christians in Syria are facing right now is heavily loaded with history. So tell us, in the city of Raqqa, what are they facing? What are the big threats?
The big threat is not only in the city of Raqqa, but the whole Syria is mainly those thousands of jihadists, the Islamist extremists, flooded into Syria from all over the world to fight, to bring the Islamic State they dream about to Syria. 90% of the jihadists in Syria are foreigners. Imagine the minorities in Syria, which are part of the social fabric of the society, are asked either to pay a levy, a tax, Islamic tax, for their protection, or become Muslims, or get killed.
Right. When you say foreigners, we're talking here, and I read this, that this was an ultimatum presented by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or yes. ISIS, on ISIS. These Christians. So this is, in fact, the ultimatum that they presented. So how are the Christians reacting to that?
Well, there are very, very few choices here. So the church leaders are saying, we pay, because we don't want to convert to Islam, and we don't want to be killed.
Do the church leaders see this as just extortion?
Well, yes. We all hope that it is temporary until the whole conflict comes to an end. But you know something, Marco? What also the West turns the blind eye on is to look at the conflict in its essence. What is this politics that allows the West to turn the blind eye to the existence of Al-Qaeda and its groups in Syria? When they, the Western countries, label these groups as terrorist groups in other lands, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Europe, even in America. So why did the West allow the Syrian opposition to make this alliance with those groups to fight the regime? The alliance is wrong.
President Bashar al-Assad's forces have tried, apparently, to protect Christians through this conflict. Where's that protection now?
The regime protects itself, Marco. The regime uses Christians as a political card, as the opposition uses the minorities and Christians as a political card. Nobody cares about the existence of Christianity in Syria. They care about their own power. The conflict in Syria is a proxy war. The proxy war is between external powers fighting in Syria. Nobody has any interest to protect the Christians. They protect themselves and they use the cards to play their political games.
So you're saying Bashar al-Assad's protection of Christians is a myth?
There is no protection. Bashar al-Assad wants to protect himself. We are between two fires. One fire is the regime, which is a dictatorship. And the other fire is a fragmented, lost opposition. They don't know where to start building the country.
Reverend, you said in other interviews that dialogue is never too late in conflicts. Do you still have hope, though, for a negotiated solution in Syria?
It's a good question. What happened in Geneva was historical, regardless of the results of Geneva II. Never in the modern life of Syria, people from different parties, the different political persuasions, could sit around a table and talk. So we need to acknowledge that. And then we need to build on that. And yes, dialogue is never too late. And this is the only way that the Syrian conflict could be resolved, because no one has the advantage militarily.
In recent weeks, the spotlight has shifted away from Syria over to the crisis in Ukraine. It's not the first time that the fighting in Syria has slipped out of view. But right now, with the possibility of Russia's role diminishing in Syria, does that worry you?
The Russian role in Syria will not diminish.
You don't think
maybe
so?
Maybe there is no emphasis on the situation in Syria due to the media, because the media follows what is new. Russia's interest is still in Syria. They have a base at the Mediterranean Sea. So Russia, Iran, the powers that are supporting Assad regime are going to continue supporting him.
Reverend Nadim Nasser is a Syrian Anglican priest now living in London. He's also one of the founding directors of the Awareness Foundation. Reverend Nasser, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
There's been a wave recently of countries adopting anti-gay laws, from Russia to several countries in Africa. That's highlighted a somber reality, that it's just too dangerous to be gay in certain parts of the world. For some, the United States offers the promise of a better life. The World's Monica Campbell met with one African couple who sought refuge in the U.S., and she heard about the new obstacles they face as they try to restart their life here.
Corrine and Gertrude are a couple in their 30s. They're also from Cameroon, where it's illegal to be gay.
There you have to hide who you are. They can go and make a denunciation and the police will come and arrest you.
That's Corrine. She's seen friends in Cameroon jailed for being gay. So she and Gertrude hid their relationship. But then Gertrude did something bold. She was an activist for AIDS awareness, and she appeared in a documentary called Born This Way. It's about Cameroon's small gay rights community. In this scene, Gertrude talks about how she was gang raped for being gay. The film wasn't supposed to be seen in Cameroon, but bootleg copies got through. Corrine remembers how her family reacted when they found out she's a lesbian.
The family used to say, why are you saying that you are homosexual? What do you want to prove? You have to stay in dark. They say that is something that comes from Occident, from Europe, from America.
Then, when Gertrude went to L.A. last year for a screening of the film, Corrine called her from Cameroon. There were death threats. And one of their friends was murdered for his gay rights activism. So Gertrude stayed in California, and recently Corrine arrived with their baby daughter. They asked that I only use their first names. I met them where they're restarting their life, at a homeless shelter in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, one of the city's roughest neighborhoods. Corrine is feeding their daughter.
You know, when you see your baby smiling in the morning, it's like a beautiful day that is.
Yes. She's hungry.
I asked them what they can do here that they couldn't before.
We kiss in public. I take her hand. We walk together. That was impossible in Cameroon.
And they know not everyone gets the chance to start over.
Gertrude and her family, in some ways, are actually quite lucky compared to many other refugees and asylum seekers. They were gotten out, and gotten out fast. Most other cases end up in limbo for months or for years.
That's Layla Roberts with the Organization for Refuge, Asylum, and Migration in San Francisco. But she points out that people like Gertrude and Corrine can face additional hurdles once they've landed here.
If you are an LGBT refugee or asylum seeker, you're not going to come in with a ready-built community because you can't turn to your fellow country people.
That's how Gertrude and Corrine feel. They're reluctant to seek out Cameroonians here and risk persecution again. Another hurdle, gay refugees are often drawn to cities, but that means high living costs. So Gertrude and Corrine are taking it day by day. The public library is a bit of a second home where the little girl can look at books. Next on the list, says Corrine, is finding a place to live.
Be out of the shelter and have our home where we can make that our children, our baby girl, grow normally.
Gertrude is looking for a job as a security guard, but what she really wants to do is continue pushing for gay rights back in Cameroon.
Yes, I want to continue my job, activist.
But she'll have to do that from here, where she and her family can be out and free. For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, San Francisco.
Tomorrow, Monica has a story of a volunteer program that's trying to give gay refugees a softer landing here in the U.S. And we have a short, sobering video about the status of gay rights worldwide. That's at PRI.org and on our Instagram feed at PRI The World. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The news has been full of stories from Ukraine and Crimea all week. And the coverage of Crimea turned into a news story itself this week after an anchor at RT, a Russian state-sponsored English-language news outlet, up and quit on the air.
I'm proud to be an American and believe in disseminating the truth. And that is why, after this newscast, I'm resigning.
Liz Wall is her name, and she said she faced ethical and moral challenges working for RT, which she accused of whitewashing Putin's lies. To find out more about RT and this on-air resignation, we called on Ann Cooper. She's a journalism professor at Columbia University.
It's not too surprising, given that RT is a state broadcaster completely financed by the Russian state, created to, you know, try to get Russia's message out to the world.
So is this also a test, do you think, for RT, where episodes like this really raise the question, are you guys authentic journalists or not?
I don't know. I mean, my students here at Columbia Journalism School 3 years ago did a study of several of these state-funded 24-hour all-news channels that are trying to reach a global audience. You know, what we found, well, the students said when it came to reporting about Russia, it tended to be kind of a silly feature about Russian felt puppets. It just, you know, it wasn't doing serious coverage of Russia.
I would put to you, though, Anne, that there's Voice of America here in the United States, and aren't some Western news outlets bearing a kind of anti-Russia bias?
Maybe, you know, back during the Cold War, it was more like that. But I think it's, you know, there are a lot of good, solid journalists working for Voice of America, I think doing a pretty good job of covering the news.
What are the origins of RT?
It began in 2005, and right around that time, you began to see a number of governments around the world deciding, we're going to invest a lot of money in creating something like this, because we want to get our message out to the world. Al Jazeera, which is totally financed by the Emir of Qatar in the Middle East, was the first to really do this in a big way, and you began to see other countries kind of following in its footsteps, and almost this kind of global media war going on.
And do you think that with the rise of all these kind of government channels, do you see a lot of journalism and news headed in this direction?
The interesting thing is when we looked at these channels, it was virtually impossible to get any information on who's actually watching them. I don't have the sense that any of them are really getting an audience here. So ultimately, what is their impact? You know, we all pay attention when you have something dramatic, like an anchor, you know, quitting on air. Does it mean that we've been tuning in RT all the time? Probably not.
Ann Cooper, journalism professor at Columbia University. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
No doubt Crimea is in the media spotlight, but it's also a place that's close to Svetlana Boym's heart. She teaches in the Slavic department at Harvard and writes about Russian culture.
Most important thing about Crimea for me, and it's a place I love and a place I visited many summers in my childhood, is that Crimea really is a cultural crossroads and has been cultural crossroads for centuries. And for instance, if you travel to the Crimea, you can see Greek ruins, Italian fortresses, the palace of the Crimean Khan, synagogues in the caves. Mm.
And all these cultures brought their arts with them. What are your favorite kind of literary works that are connected to Crimea?
Crimea actually plays a prominent role in the Russian literature, usually as a place of adventure, as an exotic place, a place of escape. So the first work that comes to mind is Alexander Pushkin's so-called Oriental poem, The Fountain of Bakhchisarai. Of course, it's a love triangle that takes place in the harem of the Crimean Tatar Khan, who captures a beautiful slave from Poland called Maria, and another slave woman, Zimfira, is jealous of her. So here we have kind of cross-cultural encounter that does not end well, but it ends with a beautiful site, the Fountain of Bakhchisarai, that supposedly embodies the tears, or is it tears of this slave girl Maria who dies in the harem, and it inspired Pushkin.
Do you know any lines from this poem off the top of your head?
Oh, my God.
I'd put you on the spot.
And yes, you did. It has a kind of interesting lines in the ending that though Zimphira's crime was great, her punishment was even greater. And that kind of works for a lot of Russian and Soviet history.
Now, my earliest cultural exposure to this part of the world, Svetlana, was seeing the famous 1925 silent film Battleship Potemkin. It's not set in Crimea, but in the nearby southern Ukrainian seaport of Odessa, where I think it was actually shot as well. Has Crimea inspired any movies that you think need mentioning?
There are many films of the Soviet time. The one that comes to mind was a beloved film of my parents' generation. It was called The Prisoner of the Caucasus. It was really a comedy, although the title is taken from Pushkin and Tolstoy. In English, it was called Kidnapping, Caucasian style. And of course, Caucasus was filmed in the Crimea. And it's again a kind of love drama and a comedy as well, which all Soviet kids used to know.
Now, as you said, you spent many summers in Crimea as a girl, Svetlana. When you hear the word Crimea, what fills your imagination?
I immediately imagine Crimean landscape. And the place where I used to go is called Koktebel. It's from Crimean Tatar, the land of blue hills. And it was a place where you have three landscapes, the steppes, the mountains, and the sea. And it was really a place where perhaps I dreamt about leaving Russia at the end, where I imagined other lands and where I developed kind of lifelong friendships. So for me, it's very important not just to think about ethnic conflicts, although this is, of course, a place from where Crimean Tatars were deported during Stalin's times, Jewish population disappeared. But I still would like to think about this place as a kind of place of possibilities for cultural encounters. And often the conflicts are political rather than ethnic. And I think in a place like Crimea, it's really important to remember that.
Well, that's a nice memory that we haven't really heard in the last few days.
Yes, and I think it's really kind of tragic, perhaps, but also ironic that Putin wages wars on the sites of former Soviet resort towns. Like in Georgia, it was Suhumi and Batumi, which is Abkhazia, which many of us visited. And now in the Crimea, this is also kind of a beautiful, almost Edenic place that you cannot imagine as a war zone.
Svetlana, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Svetlana Boym is a professor at Harvard and the author of The Future of Nostalgia. We end the program with a bit of the soundtrack to the Soviet comedy Svetlana mentioned, Kidnapping Caucasian Style, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.